Thank you for coming. This is going to be a talk about the Knights Templar, and I'll be covering briefly some of the fictional stories, some of the legends that have arisen about them. We need more volume. More volume on the mic?
Yeah.
Or should I just get it closer?
Use the 1 through 4.
I'll just keep talking and you guys can adjust. So I'll be going over some of the legends involved with the Knights Templar and a bit about the origin of some of these legends, but I think the majority of the talk is going to be about the actual fact of the Knights Templar. It wasn't a secret society, really. They're still saying more volume. It was actually a kind of the world's first multinational corporation that existed for about 200 years, mostly during the time of the Crusades, and it was a very, very well-known organization. So people in the back, can you hear me now? Yeah, they're saying more volume, more volume, more, more power. Okay, I'm just going to keep talking. Okay, so a couple of things that I'm going to be touching on briefly here. So we have a chapel in Scotland that some people say is associated with the Templars. There's the legend of the Holy Grail. Did the Templars keep the Grail? Did they have it? Do they know where it is today? Baphomet, and this whole idea of were the Templars involved in devil worship, and was this an image of the idol that they were worshiping? Another artifact is the Shroud of Turin, and what connection does it have with the Knights Templar? And this is a really interesting painting. It's from Versailles, which has a wonderful art museum, and they have a whole hall in Versailles called the Hall of the Crusades. And so this is one of these massive wall-size paintings, which is called, the English translation is Jacques Molay Takes Jerusalem, 1299. So it looks like a very plausible representation of a battle that occurred in 1299, where Jacques Molay, the last Grand Master of the Knights Templar, was engaged in a battle to recapture Jerusalem. The only thing is, there was no such battle. Jacques de Molay was probably never even in Jerusalem, so it's interesting how these legends kind of get started, and then they kind of take on a life of their own, and then people start giving them more and more validity, and then you get to the point of where you're walking through a museum and you think, oh, okay, 1299 battle must have really been a battle. No such battle. So where do these rumors come from? A lot of it just comes from fiction. Someone's writing a book, and it could be a book as recent as The Da Vinci Code from 2003. You could go back many more years to something such as Ivanhoe by Sir Walter Scott. Umberto Eco with Foucault's Pendulum also really did a lot for the conspiracy theories and putting in more information about the Templars. New book coming out September 15th, Dan Brown's next novel, the sequel to The Da Vinci Code, is coming out, The Lost Symbol. And after Da Vinci Code, huge bestseller, there was a wonderful book called Secrets of the Da Vinci Code, which was where actual scholars went out and debunked a lot of the stuff that Dan Brown said in the Da Vinci Code. There's also Secrets of Angels and Demons. There's also going to be a book called Secrets of the Lost Symbol, which is going to be debunking whatever Dan Brown says in this upcoming book, Lost Symbol. I will be one of the contributors to the Secrets of the Lost Symbol. So I haven't read the book yet. I get my copy of the novel the same time everybody else does, September 15th. Then we have to ship our manuscript by the first week of October. So it's a very rapid turnaround. So I'm kind of writing the stuff that I think he's going to get wrong now, and then I'll see when I actually read the book and kind of change things, and we'll go from there. And there'll probably be an additional edition. So Da Vinci Code was especially bad in terms of putting a lot of bad information into the public minds because of this little statement in the front where he said, all descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. No, they are not. He couldn't even get basic geography right. There were places where it would say, and then so-and-so, you know, Langdon went north down this street. Well, no, but it was south that he should have been going at that point. So really fundamental errors. And I should say a little bit about why I'm even giving this talk in the first place. I owe a huge debt of gratitude to DragonCon over the years, because my career, I mean, I have a book out on secret codes, and I'm on TV. I'm recognized as one of the world's number one experts on famous unsolved codes. There's a sculpture in the middle of CIA headquarters called Kryptos. It's a challenge to the employees at the CIA. There's 4 codes on it. 3 of the 4 have been solved. The 4th has not been solved yet. It's one of the most famous unsolved codes in the world. I'm the world's expert on that. And a lot of it all started at Dragon Con, which is, and very briefly how that story started was, my day job is that I make computer games. I'm based out of St. Louis, Missouri. I've been making computer games for about 20 years. And I was invited here to Dragon Con about 10 years ago or so to speak about computer games. And I was speaking in this track, the Electronic Frontiers track, speaking about games. And while I was here, I got to know other speakers in the track. And other speakers in the track would be the hackers coming in to talk about computer security. So I got to know the other speakers. You know, we'd wave in the halls or, you know, share a beer at the end of the day, hacking 201 panel or something. And through them, I heard about this code called the Freaknik 3 code, which was a code that had been released at the Nashville Hacker Convention Freaknik. And it had been a year. No one had cracked the code yet. So they were handing out flyers with this code saying, can anyone crack this code? We'll give you a prize. And so I took the flyers, along with all the other flyers, you know, you get around Dragon Con, and I took it home to St. Louis. Then I started looking at it. And long story short, I cracked the code, won the prize, free trip to a HackerCon, free hotel, drinks, t-shirts, and all that. Not that it's hard to get free drinks at a HackerCon, but... And then I went around cracking a bunch of other codes, and then I, again, taking a really long story and shortening it, I started giving talks about codes. And as I was giving talks about codes, and especially about this sculpture, Kryptos, and I'll be giving a talk about Kryptos tomorrow here, again, in the EFF track, so you can hear a longer version of the story that I'm making very short. But as I was talking about Kryptos, right around 2003 or so, people were coming up to me and saying, what does Kryptos have to do with this book called The Da Vinci Code? I'm like, I don't know. I never heard of Da Vinci Code. So I'm like, okay, I got to go read The Da Vinci Code. So I went and I read The Da Vinci Code, and hidden in the artwork of the book jacket of The Da Vinci Code, there's puzzles hidden in the artwork, which are giving clues to the subject of Brown's next novel. And he's done this before with two of his earlier books, where there's codes either on the book jacket or maybe in the last pages of the book, which are giving clues to the subject of the next book. For example, one of the books, the code comes out to say, the Da Vinci Code will surface. So that was a clue to the Da Vinci Code coming out. So, I found out that in the artwork of the book jacket for Da Vinci Code, there's two puzzles that refer to the sculpture Kryptos at CIA headquarters, which I happen to know something about. So that's interesting. So I started researching more about the Da Vinci Code. And as I was researching more about Da Vinci Code, and I was finding this all descriptions of artwork, and I found it, no basis in reality here. There was all these errors. So I started giving talks about the fact and fiction of the Da Vinci Code and showing what was right and what was wrong. And then when I gave those talks, and people were coming up and they were asking me questions about specific things. For example, all this stuff about the Knights Templar. And more questions were coming. I'm like, okay, well, I guess I have to give a talk about the Knights Templar now. So here I am giving a talk about the Knights Templar. And next year I may give a talk based on the questions that you guys are going to be asking me, so you can think about what you want me to talk about next year. So Da Vinci Code, the information there did not really come just wholesale out of Dan Brown's head. A lot of it he got from other books that talked about conspiracy theories. And so when we're talking about the Templars and where the information comes from, not just from fictional novels, but also from dangerous things, what I call pseudo-history novels, or pseudo-history books. So there was this book that came out in the 80s called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, that was written not as a work of fiction, but as a work of scholarship, of investigation, of proposing theories. And this book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, had this thing about saying, and there was a list of facts. We don't know if this is true, we don't know if this is true, but we know these things as facts. And one of the facts is there's this real organization called the Priory of Sion that was founded in 1099 and had a series of grand masters, including Leonardo da Vinci. So Dan Brown used this in Da Vinci Code as well to talk about the Priory of Sion and how the Knights Templar were the military arm of this Priory of Sion, none of which is true. So I have this in italics. This is not true, but these are the things that Da Vinci Code was saying. They said that the Priory of Sion was founded in 1099, had a series of secret grandmasters. They founded that the Priory of Sion founded the Knights Templar, and that there were documents verifying this Priory of Sion that had been found in a pillar in a French church in the 1800s by a priest named Béranger Saunière. Now, Béranger Saunière was a real person. And he did live in the 1800s, and he did come into a lot of money in a very mysterious way. But I'll go into more details about that in a bit. So the reality. So now we're not in italics. So this is true. The Knights Templar, they really, it's a real organization. It did exist. It was an organization of warrior monks. They existed roughly from about 1119 to about 1312. They were effectively a multinational corporation. They were involved with everything, finances, running business. They had their own fleet of ships. At one point, they even owned the entire island of Cyprus. They were connected to the church. They were connected to royalty. Definitely not a secret society. It was like saying Microsoft was a secret society. Okay, they were just everywhere, all right? They had a series of fortresses. This is the Holy Land. So in the yellow there, that's kind of the area where Israel is today, and then going north, Cyprus and or Syria. And then in the left, on the left is where we have the island of Cyprus. So these little dots going all the way up and down the slide, these are major fortifications that the Templars had. All right. The founder, and again, this is fact, was Hugh de Payon. He had been a veteran of the First Crusade. Quick history refresher, the Pope sent a whole bunch of people down south to go recapture Jerusalem. They recaptured a lot of bloodshed, but Jerusalem was recaptured, liberated, depending on which side you're talking to, in 1099. And after Jerusalem was captured by the Christians, they basically slaughtered the entire local population. So there were very few people left in Jerusalem at the time. And Jerusalem, it's not a coastal city, it's an inland city. And once Jerusalem was under Christian control, there were a lot of Europeans that wanted to go visit Jerusalem. Like, hey, okay, it's under Christian control. Let's go see the holy places. Let's see, where was Christ crucified? And let's go see his tomb, and let's go see these things. So the Europeans would leave Europe, they go by ship, and they go across to the coastline of what today is Israel. They go to Jaffa, and then they'd have to go about 100 miles inland to Jerusalem. That travel inland was incredibly dangerous, because though Jerusalem was under control, the land was not, and there were just bandits everywhere, and pilgrims were being slaughtered, sometimes by the hundreds, as they were going inland trying to make the trek across into Jerusalem. So Hugh de Payon, who, again, veteran of the First Crusade, he came up with an idea, and he got about several of his relatives together, all from kind of the same area of northern France, and they went to the king, the Christian king of Jerusalem at that time, and they said, hey, we'd like to kind of put together a monk order to try and protect, I'm getting a lot of feedback, we'd like to kind of protect these pilgrims that are going back and forth so that they're not slaughtered all the time. And the King Baldwin said, okay, sounds like a great idea. And he let them set up a headquarters on the Temple Mount. And this little monastic order, again, just a few guys, really poor, and so they really relied on donations to even survive. Now, the headquarters that they had at the time was actually on what's today known as the Temple Mount. This is probably the best known building on the Temple Mount. It's built over a rock on the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount, and this is, let me see if I can get this. Temple Mount is a series of structures. So here's that with the structure with the gold dome I was talking about. There's another structure over here with a gray dome. If you've heard of like the Wailing Wall is here. So this entire area here is incredibly important to multiple faiths. So in Judaism, it is the holiest site in Judaism. So when they say, where did God create the dust to create Adam? It was from the Temple Mount. If you've heard of the Temple of Solomon, that was on the Temple Mount. The Ark of Covenant, which held the stone tablets that God gave to man, those were there on the Temple Mount. And so this Temple of Solomon, that this area was referred to several times, both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. Like, for example, where Jesus chased away the money changers. That was on the Temple Mount. Now, it's also a big deal to Muslims. It's the third holiest site in Islam. And a lot of that comes from a story from the life of Muhammad. And here I'm kind of giving you another side of the Temple Mount. And that was Muhammad lived around 600s or so. And one of the stories that's told about him is that one evening he was resting in Mecca in Saudi Arabia, not today Saudi Arabia, but then, so he was in Mecca, and he fell asleep, and then an angel, Gabriel, came to him and brought to him a burak, which was the lightning steed. It was a sort of a Pegasus-like creature, sort of a, you can see it here, it has the central figure there is riding this figure that has the face of a human, and it was called the lightning steed. And so Muhammad mounted the lightning steed, and it took him to the farthest mosque. And they didn't say exactly where it was. They just said the farthest mosque, where Muhammad got off the steed, and then he prayed with some of the people there, and then he got back on the lightning steed, and it took him up into heaven. And in heaven, he got to meet the prophets. He got to meet Moses, he got to meet Jesus, he got to meet Abraham, and then he went up to meet God. And God greeted Muhammad and gave Muhammad certain instructions to take back to the humans on earth. And one of the instructions was to go back to the people on earth and tell them that they must pray 500 times a day. So Muhammad comes back down and he runs into Moses, and Moses says, "Did you talk to God?" And Muhammad said, "Yes," and tells him what, and I pray 500 days. Moses says, 500 times a day, they'll never do it. Go back, ask for a lower number. So Muhammad goes, this is the story, this is the legend. So Muhammad goes back to God and says, 500, can't do it. And so they go through this negotiation process back and forth, finally reducing the number of 500 times a day down to 5 times a day. And then, okay. And then Muhammad comes back to earth, gets back on the Burak, goes back to Mecca. So again, where was this location from which Muhammad went up into heaven? And it just said the farthest mosque. So at the time, there was great debate. Where was the farthest mosque? Where was the farthest mosque? And it was generally decided that the farthest mosque must have been on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Jerusalem was already considered a holy city at the time. As a matter of fact, it was where a lot of the Muslims faced when they chose to pray. And then after Muhammad died, and after the Muslims finally recaptured Jerusalem from those heathen Christians, and then after they recaptured it, they were able to build some structures on the Temple Mount. So again, looking at these structures here, at the time of Muhammad's journey, supposedly journey to heaven, these buildings did not exist. These buildings weren't on the Temple Mount. But after the Temple Mount was captured, and this was before the Crusades, so this was around the year 720 or so. After that, Muslims came in and they built a mosque here, and they called it Al-Aqsa Mosque, the farthest mosque, naming it after the story of Muhammad. Though many Muslims in modern day, when they say Al-Aqsa Mosque, oh, that's the mosque that Muhammad went to. But there's some mix-up with the timelines. But this mosque is today called the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which does mean the farthest mosque. So it was in that mosque, and here's a close-up view. So again, you can see the silver dome. This mosque was what was given by King Baldwin to the Knights Templar, to this new monastic order, to say, okay, here's what you can use as your headquarters. Something else I should say about the Temple Mount is that, again, this was where it's believed that the Temple of Solomon was. This is where the Ark of the Covenant was. And there's debate among different historians. Was the Ark of the Covenant kept here? Was it kept here? But it's generally agreed that it was somewhere in this area. So the Crusaders called this area, they called it the Temple of Solomon. Even though the temple wasn't there, they called it Solomon's Temple. And so that's where they got their name of Templars. They were the Knights of the Temple, Knights Templar. So, but they had their headquarters here in this reconverted mosque. So they had this mission. They were monks, but at the same time they were also warriors, and that they were protecting the pilgrims that were going back and forth from the coast. And this was a very controversial idea at the time. This idea of warrior monks was new, and some people were very much against the idea that there could be monks who would also be wielding weapons. And some people were actually talking about they shouldn't even be allowed to do this at all. But they had a very powerful protector in Bernard de Clairvaux, who's currently Saint Bernard de Clairvaux, and he spoke very persuasively on their behalf, and he wrote very persuasively on their behalf, and this is one of the famous sayings by him, saying, "A Templar knight is truly a fearless knight and secure on every side, for his soul is protected by the armor of faith, just as his body is protected by the armor of steel. He is thus doubly armed and need fear neither demons nor men." This was a radical idea at the time. But because of his influence, and he was very influential throughout Europe, and at the Council of Troyes, which was held in this kind of red area of France up there, where they had the church leaders kind of go in and discuss different things about church business. So in 1129, they discussed this order, these Templar Knights, and decided that they would give them the formal blessing of the church, saying, okay, they have the official papal, seal of approval. And with that, they suddenly became an authorized charity in Europe. And so anyone in Europe that wanted to donate money to help with the fight in the Holy Land, to help with the Crusades, now had a good place to give money to. We'll give it to the Templars, and the Templars will put it to good use. We know that the Templars are a good charity, sort of like you watch on TV today, and there's all these people asking you for money, and you don't know if they're real or not. Well, after the Council of Troyes, the Templars were known as a real organization, a worthy organization. So people gave them money. They gave them large tracts of land, if you've heard that term. So large tracts of land were given to the Templars. Noble-born sons, a family that wanted to give one of their sons to the fight on the Holy Land, would encourage him to join the Templar order. And so with all this money coming in, land people gave them businesses, they would, when they died, they'd will all their goods to the Templars. And so the order of the Templars started becoming very powerful. Sometimes if a nobleman in Europe wanted to go and fight in the Crusades, but what was he going to do with his home, with his vineyards and all this, and was it still going to be there when he came back? How would he know that it was going to be run well and that it wasn't going to be taken over by some corrupt cousin or whatnot? So often what he would do is he would put all of his business under the control of the Templars while he was gone. Templars would run it for him, and then when he came back from the Crusades, they would hand it back over to him. The Templars also became a kind of banking system because they were a very trusted organization. So today, if we have retirement funds, 401k, IRA, they didn't have that then, but what you could do is you could take your nest egg, the money you were saving, and put it under the control of the Templars. It would be kept in a Templar guardhouse. And then when you became older and you needed the funds, you would go and you get it from the Templars. So the Templars developed this aura of they would protect things. Anything of value, it must be under the control of the Templars. So another thing that the Templars had is because as they were traveling back and forth from Europe to the Holy Land, and they had to cross these borders and everyone wanted to tax them or wasn't happy with, you know, armed people kind of passing through their territory. So Pope Innocent in 1139 passed what's called a papal bull, which was an official document that generally named after the first few words in the document called, my Latin's not good, but Omne Deus Optimum, which means that the Templars were exempt from any local laws. They could pass freely through any border. They didn't have to pay any taxes. The only authority that they had to subject to was really the Pope. So again, this made the Templars even more powerful. The way that the Templars were organized, well, there were basically three groups in the Templars. There were the knights, the sergeants, and the clergy. The knights had to be of knightly descent. They were the ones that wore the white robes with the red cross. Then you had the sergeants, who were lower born, and they had the darker robes. And then the clergy, who would serve the spiritual needs of the knights. There's no exact numbers, but it's guesstimated that there was probably about 50,000 Knights Templar at peak. About 10% of those were actual knights. But again, that's kind of a guess. But they were the heaviest armament of the day. They were the heavy tanks. They had the funding, they had the training, they had the authority, and there were many, many battles in the Crusades where the Templars would be at the front lines, and they would have these huge horses, heavily armed war horses, and you've got the knights on top of there, big guys, and they would form this wedge, and they would just gallop full at the opposite line. And pretty much the opposite line would kind of scatter when you see all these Templars coming at you. And the Templars were not afraid for themselves. They actually swore oaths that they were not going to leave the battlefield until either it was victory or they were going to fight to the death. Even if the Templar flag fell, they were not allowed to leave the battlefield. They'd have to look to see maybe there was another order, like the Knights of the Hospital or the Teutonic Knights. And so they would have to regroup with one of the other Christian orders and not be allowed to leave the battlefield unless, you know, all flags had fallen. And so they really were respected not only by the Christian side, but the Muslims respected them as well because they were very honorable warriors. They were, again, strong, well-trained, and they wouldn't retreat. So the Templars, there was a master in each region, and these were the various regions. I won't go into the details, but these were the regions around Europe and the Holy Land. And then there was one Grand Master over the entire order. Grand Master, it was a lifetime appointment, though considering that this was a warrior order, that could be a very short short period of time. Most of the Grand Masters did die in office. Some of them died in battle. For example, they'd lead their troops, you know, charging into this Muslim force, and then the other non-Templars didn't go in, and so the Templars would just get surrounded and were all beheaded. And so there was at least one Grand Master that was killed that way. So they did have several building projects. The headquarters, this was their headquarters in England, and they had this a common element was these round buildings. And it has nothing to do with what Brown was saying about sacred feminine or the round buildings that was based on the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, which is where Christ's tomb was, where he was crucified, where his tomb is. And that was in a round structure. So that was the reason that the Templars were building these round structures. Now, one thing that they did have was secret was their initiation ceremony, the reception ceremony, initiation. It did tend to be held in secret, and they had to give vows of chastity and piety. They had to sign over all of their worldly goods to the order. This was most of them. This order went on for a couple hundred years, so there were different classes of Templars. There were some married men that joined the order. They could join for just a finite period of time, saying, "I'm going to be a Templar for 2 to 3 years, and then I'm going to go back to my wife." There were some that could, there were all different kinds of joining. So Temple and Templar is all over Europe, especially in England, for example. If you go to the Temple Tube Station, the Temple Subway Station, that's called that because it's near that Templar headquarters. If you go to the Temple Bar, the Temple Gateway, is again named after the Templars. So pretty much anything named Temple in England is based on the history of the Templars from there. I told you about this with the banking. Oh, they also originated kind of the idea of letters of credit. So a pilgrim that was traveling from Europe down to the Holy Land, instead of carrying their gold with them, they would figure out a way where they would deposit their gold with the Templars in Europe. The Templars would give them a letter, some say an encrypted letter, and then the pilgrim would take that letter with them to the Holy Land and then present the letter and be able to withdraw their funds while they were in the Holy Land. So this made the pilgrims less attractive targets for thieves as they were traveling back and forth. A few of the battles that the Templars were involved with, but this is just a tiny, tiny list. There were many battles. This was really the turning point in the Crusades. This was Saladin, wonderful, incredible leader, who was able to reunite the splintered factions of some of the Muslims and was able to turn the tide in the Crusades. So where, and the Christians, some of the Templar grandmasters were not, they were good political leaders, but they weren't necessarily good military leaders. And because of that, they had some horrible losses. One of those major losses was called the Battle of the Horns of Hattin in 1187. And it was at this battle that the tide turned from the Christians back to the Muslims. And then after this, the Muslims were able to recapture Jerusalem. So at the Knights Templar headquarters, which had been in Jerusalem at that time after 1187, moved north to the city of Acre. And they were able to keep Acre for about 100 years, and then Acre was lost in 1291. Some Templars moved their headquarters north up here to Tortosa, and then a few years later they were completely kicked off the mainland and went off to Cyprus. So then the Muslims completely controlled this part of the world. So after 200 years of Crusades, as the Christians had been starting to lose battles, they weren't as popular a charity in Europe. People didn't want to be giving as much money to something kind of the losing side. So support in Europe for the Crusades had gradually been waning. And especially after they'd completely lost all of the land in the Holy Land and they were now just at a headquarters in Cyprus, there were some people saying, why do we need these military orders? What are they doing? They're still going back and forth through all these borders. They're not paying taxes. How is this good for us? So there was some movement to try and combine the orders. Well, let's take the Knights Templar and the Knights of the Hospital and join them into a single order. And the Pope wrote to the head of the Templars and the head of the Knights of the Hospital and said, would you guys like to join? And they said no. So the Pope said, come on down and let's all talk about this. So the Grand Masters of both orders were going to meet with the Pope, and meeting meant we're going to get together this year and try to discuss these things. So Jacques de Molay arrived first, but the Grand Master of the Knights of the Hospital was several months delayed getting there, so while they were waiting for him, Jacques de Molay and the Pope were talking about other things. And one of the things they were talking about was that there was someone who'd been kicked out of the Templars a few years ago who'd made all these charges about, oh, they kicked me out because they didn't like me. They kicked me out because, well, they're not good Christians and they spit on the cross and they do this and all that. And it was probably fake charges, but they still needed to be investigated and addressed. So the Pope wrote to King Philip at the time, King Philip of France, and said, can you help with this investigation? Well, King Philip at the time was heavily in debt to the Templars. He was involved with war with the English, and he kept borrowing more money, and he really didn't want to pay it back to the Templars. And so when the Pope wrote to him and said, hey, can you help me with, you know, these Templars, they're being falsely charged, and Philip was like, well, maybe it's not so false after all. And so he decided to start pressuring the Pope to disband the Templars as a way of Philip not having to pay his debts back to the Templars. And he'd done this kind of thing before, and he liked bullying whoever the current pope was. Two popes before Pope Clement, there had been Pope Boniface and Philip, there'd been a power struggle that had been going on for a while where Philip was trying to tax the clergy. He put like a 50% tax on the clergy in France. And Pope Boniface was saying, you can't do that. These are men of God. And Philip said, well, yeah, I can do that. And Boniface, no, you can't. And the Pope is higher than the king. And which was not a good thing to say to King Philip, because it really kind of pushed things to the brink there. And so Philip had Boniface kidnapped and beaten. And this was an elderly pope at the time. And also Philip charged the pope with heresy. Charge said that the Pope had been, you know, urinating on the cross, spitting on the cross, had been doing all these horrible things. It was all just trumped up charges. But after Boniface was kidnapped, the people in Italy went and they rescued Boniface, but the elderly guy had already been beaten and he died about a month later. So they go into conclave, they choose a new Pope, and this is Pope Benedict. Benedict also, you know, tries to get into this power struggle with Philip. Benedict dies a few months later, probably because he was poisoned by one of Philip's agents. So the cardinals go into conclave again, going, okay, what do we do now? They stayed in conclave for a year, trying to figure out what to do. Who were they going to choose as pope? What they finally did was they chose this guy who'd been a childhood friend of Philip's, who became Pope Clement. Pope Clement actually moved the papacy from Italy to France. So if you've ever heard of something like called the Avignon papacy or the Avignon captivity, that was because Pope Clement moved everything to France. I mean, Philip was effectively in control of the papacy at that time anyway. So Philip was really pressuring Clement to disband the Templars. Clement wasn't a complete lapdog of Philip's at the time, but you know, it was definitely a power struggle. So Philip decided to kind of force his hand, and October 13th, not related to the legend of Friday the 13th, but I'll go into this, but it was a Friday, October 13th, 1307, hundreds of Templars around France were simultaneously arrested. It was like a dawn raid. Like imagine you get up in the morning and CNN says, Microsoft executives all arrested simultaneously around the world. I mean, that's the kind of scandal that this thing was. And when you hear rumors saying like all Templars everywhere, no, Templars in France. This was a power play by King Philip. So the other European leaders were scandalized. There was huge confusion. Again, there's a kind of slow motion confusion going on because they didn't have cell phones and CNN. But Philip had many of the Templars, including Jacques de Molay, he had them arrested, he had them tortured, he had them issuing confessions under torture, and a lot of the charges that were being issued against the Templars were the same charges as he'd issued earlier against Pope Boniface, saying that they'd been urinating on the cross, spitting on the cross, committing heresy, all these things. So it was just, it was in the pattern of things that Philip was doing. So Clement finally, you know, a couple weeks later, November 22nd, he issues a bull saying, okay, all European monarchs, let's arrest all the Templars, seize their assets, let's see what's going on, let's try and have some formal trials here. So some of the Templars had some legal experience and tried to defend themselves in trials. Philip wouldn't have that either. Had those Templars had and used the earlier forced confessions to have them declared guilty and had them burned at the stake in Paris. This was nasty stuff that was going on. But he did this to keep them from being able to testify to defend themselves at the papal trials. So after more bullying from King Philip, finally Pope Clement issued a bull saying, Vox in excelsio, disband the Templars. Microsoft is gone. The Templars are no longer in existence. And then a couple months later, he issued this ad providam saying, okay, everything that the Templars had now belongs to the Knights Hospital. And this was sort of tweaking at Philip, because Philip wanted all the assets given to him. But the Pope said, no, give them to the Knights Hospital. So again, when you hear these legends, oh, what happened to the secret gold of the Templars? It all went to the Knights Hospital. I mean, that's where it went. But because this all happened so suddenly, and the Templars had really been taking care of everything in Europe for hundreds of years, there was confusion, there was chaos, there was, why did they suddenly disappear? And that really sparked a lot of legends. So Jacques de Molay, he was the one arrested, one of the people arrested, tortured, forced to confess, but he later recanted his confession. You gotta remember, he's an older man at this point. He's been in prison for a few years. I think he just wanted, my belief is that he just wanted it to be over at that point. So he was burned at the stake in Paris, next to an associate, Geoffrey de Charnay. According to legend, he called out, he asked to be tied in such a way that he was facing the Notre Dame Cathedral as he was burning, so that he, and to have his hands tied together in prayer. And according to legend, he called out from the flames that both Philip and Clement would soon meet him before God. Clement died within the month. King Philip died before the end of the year. So that added in more to legends as well. And also, not only did Philip die before the end of the year, but then his son became king, that son died, then the next son died, then the next son died. Within a few years, his entire line was gone. There's a wonderful French miniseries called Les Rois Maudits, the Accursed Kings. I've been trying to get a copy of it to see it, but that talks about this whole thing about the accursed line. So what happened to the remaining Templars? Well, some of them finally did go through papal trials. Virtually none were actually convicted of anything. Many were just allowed to retire. Some of them, for example, in Portugal, where they said, okay, the Knights Templar cannot exist anymore, they said, okay, we're changing our name. Now we're the Order of Christ. They said, okay. It was the same organization. Yes, question.
What happened in England? Because wasn't France at war with England? So how did France manage to convince... How did France manage to convince England to go along with this whole arrest thing?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure about the exact details. I mean, there were some things, for example, Scotland was excommunicated at the time, and so that was led into some of the legends. Where did the Templars go? Maybe some of them fled to Scotland at the time. And it's hard to piece together exactly what did and didn't happen. But it's a good question. I just don't know the exact answer.
And the other thing is, were most of the individual Templars politically connected themselves? I mean, they were all from noble families, really, so that would have led to them being reluctant to pursue this.
Yeah, the question was, you know, a lot of the Templars were politically connected. Well, some of them were. Some of them definitely were from noble descent, and sometimes noble descent meant political power, sometimes it didn't. Sometimes it meant money, sometimes it didn't. There were plenty of people who had titles but were completely poor, and you also had the reverse going the other way. So I think it was a combination of things, and that was part of why in 1310 King Philip had some of the Templars burned at the stake, because those Templars were a little more connected, had more education, had more legal training, and that's why he stalled that by having them all burned. It was messy business. This is just a picture of the Templar headquarters in Portugal, which is currently today a UNESCO World Heritage Site. So again, we see this round building based on the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So getting back to the fact and fiction, Friday the 13th, despite what Dan Brown says, it has nothing to do with the Knights Templar. Yes, they were arrested on a Friday that was the 13th, but this whole concept of Friday the 13th didn't really even come into existence until late 1800s, early 1900s. Now, 13 was definitely considered an unlucky number. That's fact. Friday was definitely considered an unlucky day. But Friday the 13th, no. And you can go and look for, like, dictionaries of folklore or any kind of history. I mean, people were writing about this stuff for hundreds of years. What's witchcraft? What's this? What do these terms mean? What does this language mean? And there's no referral to Friday the 13th before around 1900 or so. It just wasn't in the language. It probably came into popular usage around 1900 or so when a politician did something really stupid on a Friday the 13th. And the newspapers just, oh, how stupid can you be to do something on a Friday the 13th? And then that kind of got into popular culture from there. Baphomet, did the Templars worship this idol? Well, first of all, this image was not even created until the 1800s. So it cannot be an image of something that the Templars were worshiping. The whole idea of Baphomet, now Baphomet does exist in the Inquisitor's trial transcripts, but most scholars believe that it's just a misspelling, that the Inquisitors were trying to write the name Muhammad or Mahomet and were misspelling it as Baphomet. And then other people who didn't really know their history said, Baphomet, oh my God, it's this secret name, secret idol. Oh, the Templars must have been worshiping this. There's nothing else in the trial transcripts to indicate that the Templars were worshiping anything like a horned god or anything like this. When Baphomet was referred to, sometimes it was referred to as maybe a head with three faces or a cat. It's really kind of, there's no consistent description of what exactly Baphomet was. The Holy Grail, which is a big legend today, did the Templars, while they were at the Temple Mount, were they able to go excavating and did they find the Holy Grail? Well, the Holy Grail, the whole legend of the Holy Grail, I describe it as just medieval fan fiction. It was something, the first poem about, the first mention that we've been able to find of anything like the Holy Grail, or even, it wasn't even the Holy Grail, it was just the Graal, it was a poem called Le Conte du Graal, written in about 1180 by this Chrétien de Troyes, who was actually from kind of the same area of France as where all this other stuff was going on. But he'd written other things, and he was a popular writer of the day, and then he'd started this poem and didn't finish it for whatever reason. Was it because he died, or who knows? But it wasn't finished, but it sparked the public imagination. What was this Graal? Yeah, question.
Yeah, I mean, I had a professor, took a class like chivalry and Norse mythology and all this other stuff, and they were actually talking about the Chrétien de Troyes and the history, and you know, he did some research thinking that it actually came from the Horn of Plenty, where the idea of it, and then I think later on became a plate, which I think was in Parzival from, was it Wolfram von Eschenbach or Godfrey, right. one of those old writers.
Right.
So it was like an evolution into the cup, you know, over like a 100-200 year period.
Right, which was really fast at that time, right. Yeah, like these days you can write something and you'll have a bunch of fan fiction in a month. Then 100 years, they're like, whoa, it's just going full speed ahead. But yes, you're exactly right. They think that it was kind of a conflation of several different legends that were going on, the Horn of Plenty and other fiction that was being written at the time. Parzival had these things about Templars guarding the Grail Kingdom, which fit in with everything else. The Templars, they guarded treasures. That's what they did. So if there was, you know, common people saying, where's the Grail? I don't know, but the Templars must have it. So it's very natural to think that that's kind of how these things came together. Okay, another question in the back.
Yes, how did the Templars become associated with the origination of the Masons?
Okay, the connection with the Templars and the Masons. I have a couple slides. I'm definitely going there. But yeah, I will be covering that. Okay, anything else urgent? Okay, so Roslyn Chapel. Roslyn Chapel has a lot of imagery in it that seems to have both connections to the Templars and also to the Masons. Now, the whole idea of Freemasonry is probably a whole nother talk about what are the origins of Mason. Is anyone here a Mason? Okay, so which rite? Scottish rite or?
York rite.
York rite, okay. So, I mean, there's all kinds of different stories about the origin of Masonry and the different rites of it. You guys might even be able to do a better job than I at giving some talks about Masonry. There was a combination of Templar imagery and Masonic imagery that was in this chapel. This chapel was not created until about 150 years after the Templars were disbanded, but the Templars still did have this mystique about them, and so there were a lot of people that liked to claim heritage from the Templars, though. I mean, the Templars, they all took vows of chastity, so they couldn't really have, you know, be passing things on to their sons. I can't give you a clear answer of exactly what Roslyn Chapel is about, but there were definitely some connections there. Masonry, it's generally, Freemasonry, it's generally believed that it came into public knowledge in the 1700s, and they created some rituals based on older parts of history. Now, some people would like to claim that it wasn't inspired by older history, but had actually been passed down over the centuries into the 1700s. I'm of the belief that Freemasonry was a new organization that came in around the 1700s and was inspired by things, just like people today might create a Star Wars group that is inspired by Star Wars, but that doesn't mean that it was formed by Lucas or something. They're just people that get it sparks their imagination and then they go on from there. Would you say that?
That would be Roddenberry, not Lucas.
Oops, sorry. Wait, no, Star Wars?
Yeah. Oh, I thought you said Star Trek. Sorry.
Moving right along.
Never mind.
Okay, all right. So this is one of the carvings from Roslyn Chapel that does have some Templar imagery, which is two knights on a single horse. Another story about the Templars is, what did the two knights on a single horse mean? Well, it meant that they were poor and they couldn't afford more than one horse. Though there are people today that try to say, oh, well, it meant that they were gay and they were, you know, two guys on a single horse. And so people will look at these images and they'll just kind of come up with they'll tack on any story that they think kind of links to their own lives at the time or whatever they want to believe. So officially, the historians say two riders on a single horse was meant to represent poverty. That's all it meant. Nothing more. Right. So here's another one that people say was this link to the Templars, and it actually does have a link to the Templars. The Shroud of Turin was first publicly displayed in 1357. Well, who owned it at that time? It was owned by the family of the grandson of Geoffrey de Charnay, who was the guy that was burned at the stake with Jacques de Molay in France, so those two last Templars that were burned at the stake. So many years later, then the Shroud of Turin comes out. Carbon dating is really controversial, I know, but some carbon dating implies that the Shroud of Turin was created around 1260 to 1390, which would include that last century or so of the Templars. My own belief about the Shroud of Turin is that it was a flag. If you look at the top one where you have the two images of the men, and you take it and you just fold it, and it was like one of those banners that would be carried into battle. And then someone took it apart and said it sort of looks like Jesus. But if you were to take a shroud and actually put it on someone's face, it wouldn't look like a face. It would look like this round kind of blob. You can try it. Paint someone's face and then wrap a cloth around it and then unwrap the cloth. It's not going to look like a face. It's going to look like this big oval blob. Anyway, on with the Turin. So, Priory of Sion. Getting back to the Da Vinci Code, saying, and holy blood, holy grail, that said that the Knights Templar were the military arm of the Priory of Sion. What was the Priory of Sion? How many people here have read Da Vinci Code, by the way? Okay, so what was the Priory of Sion? It was a hoax. The Priory of Sion was not this thousands of years old or hundreds of years old organization. It was an organization founded in 1956 by Pierre Plantard. Pierre Plantard was a guy in France who decided that he needed to be named King of France. So he, because he was going to help that way. He'd come out of World War II, he thought things were a mess, and he thought if he was king, he'd make things better. So in order to become king, he decided he would commit fraud. And this is the way his brain, this wasn't the first time he'd done this either. So what he and his friends did is they forged a bunch of documents. And one set of documents they hid in the Bibliothèque Nationale of France, the National Library of France. And they hid them in such a way to make them look like they'd been there for a long time. And these documents had these elaborate family trees going back, I think, like over 1,000 years, that all leading to Plantard, to indicate that Plantard was related to this line of Merovingian kings in France. This didn't get as much attention as he wanted it to get, so they decided to plant another set of documents. And they planted this set of documents in a book that they had written called Le Trésor Maudit de Rennes-le-Château, The Accursed Treasure of Rennes-le-Château. Rennes-le-Château is this tiny little village in the south of France, population 100, 150 or so. And it is to France what Roswell is to the United States, Loch Ness is to Scotland, Bermuda Triangle. Anything weird, spooky, space alien, hidden treasure, anything of that, Rennes-le-Château. That's where it's going to be taking place in France. And why was Rennes-le-Château like that? Okay, so there was this innkeeper named Noël Corbeau, who had bought a building, an estate, in this beautiful, there's mountains, lovely scenery. He bought an estate and nice restaurant, and he wanted to attract business. Well, tiny little village, 150 people, not a lot of business. So how do you get business to this little inn in the middle of nowhere? Well, there's two main ways. One, you make up a ghost story. Two, you make up a story about a hidden treasure. He decided to make up a story about a hidden treasure. And he expanded on a story about a priest named Béranger Saunière from the 1800s, who had supposedly come into a lot of money. And Corbeau started expanding on these. Well, Saunière had found something. He'd found, you know, mysterious things in a church, or he'd found the people kept expanding on the legends. Maybe he'd found the burial place of Christ. Maybe the papacy had been paying him to keep his mouth shut. Maybe he'd found this huge treasure that was buried out there somewhere. So people flood to the town, bring in their shovels, you know, staying at his hotel, eating the food in his restaurant. And that's exactly what he wanted. And all through France, they were like, oh, wow, we're in Le Château, and there's, you know, secret treasure buried down there. And so all the kooks started flocking to Rennes-le-Château, and then they started expanding on the legends. Well, maybe the treasure was brought by space aliens. Or maybe if you take this mountain and you look at these five mountains and they're sort of in the shape of a pentagram, well, maybe that was, you know, the message to the, you know, the space aliens, that this was where they needed to land. I mean, just a really bizarre stuff that was all coming out there. And one of the guys that came de Rennes-le-Château was Pierre Plantard. Pierre Plantard decided to use all of these legends around Rennes-le-Château to help promote his desire to become king. And so in a book about the accursed treasure, he and his friends forged some documents, put them in this book saying, the priest, Béranger Saunière, in a hollow pillar in the church, he found these documents. Here, we're reproducing the documents. And the documents were about the Priory of Sion. All right, so he was implying that the Priory of Sion had been around for thousands of years and that Saunière had found these documents, and because it was in the book, it must all be true. So, yeah, I already went through that. Plantard already covered that. So, we're going to fast forward. So now this book is out there. About 10 years later, a man named Henry Lincoln, visitor from England, comes along, reads the book. He is fascinated. So now he decides he wants to write his own books about it. He was also, by the way, a writer for Doctor Who. He'd been writing Doctor Who episodes in England at the time, all right? And, you know, Doctor Who's got this sort of pseudo-history thing going on with a bunch of stuff. So Henry Lincoln starts producing a bunch of documentaries for BBC Two in England about Rennes-le-Château and about the space aliens and about other stuff going on at Rennes-le-Château. And then he goes on the lecture circuit and starts making up more and more stuff about Rennes-le-Château. And in the book, Le Trésor Maudit, let me see, he said he discovered an encrypted message. And here's one of the messages. This message, follow me here, this message was printed in the book, The Accursed Treasure of Rennes-le-Château. The book said, this is a medieval document. In actuality, this was a forged document created by Plantard and his group. In this message, and I don't know if you can see it here, but there are certain raised letters. Like you see this O here, and you see this D is kind of a bit higher. You got the M over here, and you got an O, and an R, and a T, more, which means death. So if you take all those, raised letters together, you say, A Dagobert du Roi et à Sion et ce trésor et l'amour. To Dagobert II, king, and to Sion, does this treasure belong? And it is death. Really, ooh. And so Henry Lincoln was like, this is great stuff. And he started making documentaries about all this. So who was King Dagobert II? Dagobert II was a real king from French history, member of the line of the Merovingians. And he was the last of his line of the Merovingians, killed off somewhere around the 7th century. So Henry Lincoln, going on the lecture circuit here, is telling, you know, what was going on. Why would a message about Dagobert King be in this hollow pillar that was in Rennes-le-Château, and what does this have to do with this Priory of Sion? Obviously, there was an organization called the Priory of Sion because it's in the book, so obviously it really existed. So Henry Lincoln teams up with two other guys on the lecture circuit named Bagent and Lee, and they're sitting around, and you know, they're writing their own books about this stuff, and they're speculating, what does Dagobert? So, and they go back, well, you know, the Merovingian line, who's the first guy in the Merovingian line? Well, it's a guy named Merowig, and he was from the 5th century. Who was his father? We don't know. And then they were really, I mean, this is old history. They're going into history and it's going, well, Merowig. And we know that his mother supposedly went swimming and ran into a sea serpent, and the sea serpent impregnated her, and that was the beginning of the Merovingian line. I mean, they're way back into legend stuff. So Lincoln, Page, and Lee, they're sitting around in a hotel room, and they're thinking about this stuff and going, boy, this smells kind of fishy. And they're putting it in. What does this have to do with Christianity? And they said, well, fish, wasn't it that early Christians used a symbol of a fish? So this must mean that Merowig, the fish, so this must mean that Jesus Christ has something to do with Merowig. So Merowig must be the descendant of Jesus Christ. That's what it must mean. And so they put all this together and started, so Mary Magdalene, oh my God, Jesus had an affair with Mary Magdalene. And so they just come up with this in a hotel room and go on the lecture circuit. It's incredibly popular on the lecture circuit. And then they write a book about it. And the book is Holy Blood, Holy Grail. Came out in 1982. And that's where they're talking about the Priory of Sion. And so the Holy Blood. And so the chain of speculation here. So 1956, we got Noel Corbeau, this innkeeper in Rennes-le-Château, starting rumors about a hidden treasure. Okay. 1967, Plantard and his fraud cohort, they published this Le Trésor Maudit with false documents to confirm the treasure and tie it into this whole hoax thing about the Priory of Sion. 1969, Henry Lincoln, science fiction writer, comes along, finds the reference to Sion, and starts creating his own books and documentaries about it. Then we kept 1982, we have the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail comes out. 2003, Dan Brown comes along, writes The Da Vinci Code. 2006, turns into a movie, goes on from there. So, Priory of Sion, not a fact. Not a fact. Okay. Any questions so far? Yes? Oh, big Wikipedia entries. Big Wikipedia entries. Okay. All right, how are we doing? Okay. So, just a few other things about the Templars, like that big painting that I showed you about the Jacques de Molay, 1299, the battle to retake Jerusalem. Well, that was a confusion because there were some early documents from the Crusades that talked about a Mongol general named Moulay. And some modern historians, especially in the 1800s, looked at this Moulay and thought, Mongol Moulay, and thought, oh, that must mean Jacques de Molay. And they started writing these articles. And as a matter of fact, there was a playwright at the time who wrote a play about Jacques de Molay, who'd become a general in the Mongol army and had retaken Jerusalem. Well, the French monarchy, they like that. They like the idea of Jacques de Molay, you know, French going in. And so they commissioned a painter to go and create this huge painting about Jacques de Molay taking Jerusalem in 1299, now hanging Versailles. Didn't happen. Nothing to do with the Templars, no battle. Jacques de Molay was probably never even in Jerusalem. So if you want to get a good book on the Templars, Malcolm Barber is the author to read. He wrote a book called The New Knighthood, strong academic scholarship. He's the gold standard for information about Templars. He also wrote an excellent book about the trial of the Templars. Helen Nicholson, also wonderful author, wrote Knights Templar, A New History. She's recommended by Barber. They're good stuff. Books not to read, anything to do with Templars and space aliens, okay? You take it off the shelf, flip through, if it has space aliens in the back cover, don't buy it. If it says anything about Templars reconquering Jerusalem in 1299, 1300, don't buy it. Anything about Templars in charge of the Mongol army, don't get it. So, summary. Knights Templar, real organization, existed for about 200 years, 1119 to 1312 or so. World's first multinational corporation. They were arrested starting around October 1307, persecuted, completely disbanded. They had a huge impact on modern culture, especially with legends. It's a compelling story, and the stories keep building one on the next because it just really sparks the imagination. I will be giving some other talks here at DragonCon. Tomorrow I'm giving a talk about cryptos and famous unsolved codes here in this room. Talk about Wikipedia, since that came up. I am a Wikipedia administrator. It took a long time to become an administrator, but I am an admin. I have some wonderful stories there. I'll be at the Hacking 201 beer pad. The Stump the Hacker, along with Randall, will be here on Sunday evening. And a new talk about the encrypted art of James Sanborn. So the artist who created cryptos also created several other sculptures with codes on them, and I'll be talking about some of those others on Monday. Any questions here? Yes? What happened to the Portuguese Order of Christ? I haven't done a lot of research into it, but there are some who believe that they became navigators, and actually that Christopher Columbus was actually either financed by, or maybe his navigator was a member of that order, because the sails of the Columbus ships had that big cross that looked like the Templar cross on it. I haven't done a lot of research on it, but that is one of the stories I've heard. So it may be completely wrong. Just take it with a grain of salt. The red shirt in the back.
To answer that question.
Okay.
Thank you. To answer your question, the order was secularized, became a crown order, and is now currently in abeyance under the Portuguese Republic. but is still awarded by the Portuguese royal family, the Braganzas. So the order continued. It simply changed its face from being a religious order to being one of the first secular orders in Europe. So it's still around.
Thank you very much. I've learned something, okay? All right.
Do you know anything about the legend or whatever that the Templars who were not executed or not captured moved to Switzerland, and thus the inversion of the Templar flag, red cross, white, to the modern Swiss flag, and their banking industry today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of the more interesting stories. Since the Templars were bankers, were they the origins of the Swiss banking industry today? I don't know if it's true or not. I haven't read any research on it. I've read some things such as that there was a battle in the Swiss mountains where the villagers suddenly seemed to have extensive knowledge of battle tactics, as though someone had arrived and had taught them very sophisticated battle tactics, which implies that maybe someone had fled. I say it's possible. The Templars, they were not this, you know, they were not all of one brain. They were not different parts of one organism. It was tens of thousands of people. Some Templars may have gone to Switzerland. Some may have gone to Scotland. Again, I use the analogy of Microsoft. If all of the Microsoft executives were, if Microsoft went away, where would the executives go? Would they vanish? No, they'd get jobs at other companies. They'd move. They'd find other work. They would go on with their lives.
I just wanted to ask, with the whole, you know, Dan Brown thing, I mean, what do you think, like, was it just kind of sloppy research? Was it just a conscious, like, story decision that he's like, I need to create a good story? Or what do you think the whole, you know, deal with that is? I mean, it might be a little controversial.
We're recording this, right? Okay.
But I'm curious. I mean, I read it too, and I realized that some things were not, and I just wondered, I mean, like, what? Did he realize what he was doing and just said, it's going to be a story, or did he just kind of, like, you know, really not look into it too deeply?
Let me tell you about Dan Brown. Okay. Dan Brown, his father was a mathematician. He came from a pretty well-to-do family, private schools. He initially decided that he was going to become a musician, and he moved to Los Angeles. And he tried to be a musician. He released some kind of self-done CDs. Really didn't do well, but he struck up a relationship with a woman who worked, I think, at the National Songwriters Association. I need to check the name association. She started introducing him to the right people and started helping with his career. She eventually became his wife, Blythe Brown. They married and moved back to New Hampshire. Yeah, he wrote three books, all of which failed miserably. None of them sold over 10,000 copies. He wanted to write a bestseller. Then he wrote The Da Vinci Code, and he deliberately wrote it to become a bestseller. It made the New York Times bestseller list within its first week of release. After it became a bestseller, it dragged up all the sales of his first three books to the point where all four of them were on the bestseller list in the same week. Angels and Demons came out before Da Vinci Code and failed the first time. And then after Da Vinci, yeah, I like Angels and Demons better too. It's my favorite of his four. So I think that he was deliberately setting out to be controversial. I think he loves conspiracy theories. And I think that his next book, it's going to take place in Washington, D.C. It's going to be that same everything going on over a period of about 12 hours. It's going to be about the secret society of the Freemasons, and there's a lot of stuff about the Freemasons, you know, fact and fiction. So I'm going to have a really good talk next year. does that kind of answer your question?
Well, see, unlike the Templars, you know, the Freemasons are very much, you know, so it would be interesting to see how they respond to any issues.
Yeah. I was just on my way here to DragonCon. I was contacted by producers from the Discovery Channel that are already creating a documentary about the lost symbol. So there's going to be all kinds of stuff going on. Okay.
Yeah. Just, you know, judging from your track record on the research on unsolved codes and now the Knights Templar and whatnot, for people who are inspired by the research you do, can you give us some insights into your research techniques and research habits and that sort of thing?
Wow. The way I like to research is I will choose something small. I'll choose a fact that I'm interested in, and then I will try to acquire about 20 books on it. And I don't read the books all the way through. Some people, they get a book and they read the whole book, they know everything in the book. I like to go, and this is just my methodology, and I will surround myself with 20 books or so, and I'll turn them all to the page that talks about this one fact. And I'll read what each one says, because the chances that they're saying the same thing are really, really small. And the truth will usually be somewhere in between everything that the different books are saying. For the books, I look for books that are written by scholars. I look for books, which books recommend other books, which can work both ways. It can work where academics will recommend other works of academic rigorousness. And there will be conspiracy theorists who will recommend books by other conspiracy theorists. And so I'll look not just the book, but who's written the book, and what else has that person written, and have they ever written anything that has been reviewed well? And at what point in their career did they write it? Because there's some people who started writing conspiracy theories, and then they started becoming pretty good academics later in their career. And there's other people that went the other way. You know, started off as really good scientists, and then kind of went more and more into bizarre stuff. The older that they got. So it,
you do an assessment of reputation of authors to help vary mm-hmm. fact from fiction.
Yeah, that's a good way of it. I do an assessment of the reputation of authors. Yes. Okay. Sounds good. I like that. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, I think we're at time. Thank you for coming. Thank you very much.